Welcome to the Future of Science podcast. I'm your host, Philipp Köllinger from the DSci Foundation, and with me today is Professor Gustav Nilsson. Gustav is a neuroscientist at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, one of the leading medical research centers in the world. His research looks at sleep and communication between the brain and immune system. And Gustav also does research in meta science on the transparency, reproducibility, and openness in science. A few days ago, Gustav was the inaugural speaker in our Future of Science seminar series, where he talked about research objects and pathways towards community-based, transparent, and systematic quality control of science. Welcome, Gustav. Great to have you.
Hi, Philippe. It's great to be here.
Wonderful. Okay, so let us start with the question, what exactly is meta science? So I think most people probably have not heard about it. I know I'm using that term quite a bit, but maybe we can lay the groundwork there.
Sure. So I've started calling myself a meta scientist fairly recently. And what it is basically science about science. So our subject matter is research outputs like research articles that scientists publish. And the things we do can be things like looking at how transparent is this research? Can we access the data? Can we reproduce the results? Can we find the same thing?
Right.
What happens if we make different assumptions? And so on.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, meta science is this attempt of science to turn its eye on itself, right?
That's very well put.
Yeah. So it's sort of funny. So when I got started in research, which was a long time ago, like 16 years ago or so, I don't really think that meta science was a thing back then. So this has gained quite a bit of popularity and importance in the last couple of years. And I think a lot of it came from the realization that the first couple of people that actually started doing meta science and started to actually look at the replicability of research and things like that, they often found things that were pretty shocking to the academic community and that sort of like sent ripples through the system that served almost like as wake-up calls. So I'm just really curious. So I mean, you're a little bit younger than me. So how and why did you actually get involved in meta science? What's your story there?
I have fewer gray hairs, but the first time I walked
you.
In...
You're not wrong.
Only by a small amount. But I was realizing just when you said 16 years, it's 19 years now since the first time I walked into the research lab where I came to do my PhD.
Wow, yeah.
Anyway, you're absolutely right in that meta science has kind of come together as a movement in maybe the last 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. Now there are societies, there are conferences,
right.
There are a few journals. Of course, people have been looking at science much longer than that. There are people through the centuries that we could today call meta scientists, even if they didn't think of themselves that
right.
way.
Right. Can you think of some examples? Would you count like people like Popper or you know the science philosophers as part of meta science, or is that too far fetched?
I wouldn't, but I know there are some people in the field of science and technology studies. Mm-hmm. Who seem to be a bit cross that a bunch of other people have now turned up with quantitative methods to study science, and they think they're reinventing the whole thing from the ground up.
Right.
But there are some people who have been much involved in the practice of science, in statistics, the appraisal of evidence. For example, the evidence-based movement in medicine starting in the 90s had many characteristics of meta-science. There are some people who we now think of mainly as statisticians that had quite a broad view on the practice of science, like Cohen and Fisher, perhaps.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And did you sort of like have a trigger event that made you get interested in this? Or was it sort of like a gradual, marginal, like pathway into meta science?
I was always interested in how and why we can trust the findings we make in science. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why, but that interest has been with me ever since I started. And I had a kind of crisis of confidence myself around the time I finished my PhD. Mm-hmm. And that caused me to switch fields. And it was only after that I started doing neuroscience.
Wait, this is so interesting. So what did you do before you do neuroscience? And also, like, which field is actually worse in terms of replicability in neuroscience?
Well, maybe it was a case of the grass being greener on the other side. But I was doing research in experimental pathology.
Ah.
So it was on cancer.
Interesting.
Specifically malignant mesothelioma.
Okay.
And I was doing studies on cell cultures and on tissue samples and things like that.
That is so interesting. And that's when you had an aha moment.
I suppose a gradual realization. But yes, I had a kind of a reckoning with my own perception of the field and of my own work as well. Which at the end of my PhD seemed to be a bit of a house of cards.
That is such a familiar story. So, I mean, I keep hearing that from a lot of different people. So especially when you were, so I hear that particularly from people who do experimental studies, right? So people who actually collect their own data.
Yeah.
That seems to be a pretty common phenomenon. So in your seminar that you gave a couple of days ago, you talked about a triple crisis in academic research and publishing. So can you maybe just explain a little bit what that means and why this is important?
Yeah. So that is something I've written about with some colleagues, Björn Brems and others. We had a paper called Replacing Academic Journals, where we talk about three crises of academic publishing. A crisis of functionality, a crisis of accessibility, and a crisis of reproducibility. Mm-hmm. And what that refers to is that academic publishing is still stuck in the same format as it was back when journals were printed on paper.
Right.
We have largely failed to make use of the possibilities that we now have thanks to the internet and digital mm-hmm. technologies. Mm-hmm. At the same time, much of what we publish gets locked in behind paywalls.
Right.
And the traditional publishers increase their prices at an alarming rate. So that's the crisis of affordability.
Right.
And then there's the crisis of reproducibility, where we have found, and this is related to what we were talking about a moment ago with the development of meta-science as a field. So there's been talk of the reproducibility crisis for about a decade or so. And it's a kind of growing realization that when we actually try to reproduce scientific findings in many fields, it turns out that many of them can't be replicated or reproduced,
right,
even if we try as faithfully as possible. And right, these large-scale systematic attempts to reproduce findings are actually that recent. They've only been going on in the last decade.
Right. So do you think that these replication attempts, that they're sort of representative of the entire underlying fields? Or do you think that the way that meta scientists are picking their objects for replication are likely to oversample studies that received a lot of impact, but where they already had doubts that it may not replicate? In other words, you know, like, how representative is the sample that we're analyzing in meta science?
That is an excellent question. So there have been some large-scale replication attempts, and none of them have been highly representative. So some of them have chosen impactful findings, as you said, and right, others have chosen partly based on convenience, findings that were possible to replicate out of a certain sample. So I don't think we know the answer. And I also want to acknowledge that it's entirely possible that meta-science has its own biases. And so sometimes people accuse meta-scientists of trying to find low reproducibility because gives more attention and so on.
Right.
And they may be right.
Right. So yeah. I mean, this is interesting. So I've seen a lot of these large scale replication studies, and very often, sort of ones that I find personally most convincing are actually those that look at several studies that basically did like multi-lab experiments trying to reproduce studies that were sort of sampled from a particular set of journals or based on specific predefined criteria. And so what we've seen there, which is actually what is pretty shocking, is that a lot of the experiments and a lot of the evidence that we've seen getting published in really top journals, including like Nature and Science, for example, in the fields of psychology or economics, turn out to have replication rates that were much, much lower than you would actually hope for such high impact journals. So I don't know what a realistic hope would be. I think I would probably personally be very, very satisfied if we would have replication rates of maybe 80 or 90% in the top journals, but
that's extremely high.
It would, right? So that, I mean, so yeah, so that would be like, at that point, I personally would be very happy, but apparently in most fields, we're pretty far away from that margin, right? So
you can think about this in terms of hypothesis testing.
Yeah.
If you have a framework for hypothesis testing according to the traditional null hypothesis method, then the proportion of findings that come out positive depend on the statistical power that you've got, which is to say how big is the study,
right,
in relation to its design. And the other factor is how probable is the hypothesis on beforehand, the prior probability.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if we have studies of 90% power, which is way above where we're operating right now, and 100% prior probability, then we can get to 90%.
Right.
That's basically the only way. Right. or you can have 100% power, but then we'd publish maybe one study a year in the whole field.
Yeah.
So I don't think we're going to get such high reproducibility rates. And already, just based on the proportion of findings in the literature that support the author's hypotheses, which is about 90%, that immediately tells us that something is missing.
Right.
There is some kind of bias there where the negative findings either go into the drawer or they are somehow the results are analyzed until a positive finding can be found in there somewhere.
Right.
So I'm not at all surprised that we have found reproducibility rates that have been much lower than 80 or 90%.
Right.
For example, in the reproducibility project psychology that I think we've both been alluding to,
right,
came out in 2015, we found that about 1/3 of 100 papers in experimental psychology successfully replicated.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's...
So, just chew on this, right? So 1/3. Yeah. 1/3 of the studies replicated. So what does that tell us about the other 2/3?
Exactly. So when scientists always publish positive results, it means that we have no way of knowing which of the positive results we can actually trust.
Yeah.
This is not entirely intuitive, perhaps, but it's a major problem for humanity. I mean, how can we make rational decisions in society if we can't trust the scientific record?
Exactly. Yes. And so would you say that this problem, so actually all three of the problems that you were alluding to, are they widely recognized among scientists and funders and universities? Or do you think that there is still a lot of people that are not aware of these problems, or that actually argue that these problems don't exist?
Sometimes I feel like I live in a different world to some colleagues. I meet very many colleagues that are highly attuned to these problems and are trying to solve them. Of course, partly because that's the kind of circles I move in now. But I also meet many colleagues who don't think it's a problem, and also quite a lot of colleagues who think there are great problems of quality, but who conceptualize them in an entirely different way. like some colleagues that think that much of science is shoddy, and that's why we need to rely on the high prestige journals, for example, which I think is not the case.
Right. So why do you disagree with them? So, let's dig into this. Let's do this.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So the high prestige journals. These are journals like Nature, Science, in medicine, the New England Journal of Medicine. Yep. In economics, there are others. I don't know their names. These journals are highly selected. Yeah. It's very difficult to get published there.
Very, very difficult.
And if you succeed, then it can be extremely positive for your career. For a young scientist, it can make or break a career. It seems that quite a lot of people, quite a lot of my colleagues that I talk to, think that the high selectivity of the journals is a guarantee of quality.
Right.
So you need to persuade the editor, and you need to persuade a set of reviewers that the work is not merely good, but that it's a very high quality and very high relevance somehow for the field.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. But so, there are some problems with that.
Exactly. So I'm getting the sense that you probably disagree with how research quality should be defined. So I'm getting the sense that, you know, you would actually define research quality in a different way from the editors of these high impact journals. Is that right?
Yeah. So
okay.
What you get in these journals quite often is flashy results, results that could be in the news, or that somehow overturn the conventional wisdom, and that means that they are inherently a bit more risky. They have a lower prior probability.
Let's say there's
also the problem that the quality control inherent in the traditional peer review system is quite unsystematic. So usually what it consists of is sending the paper to some peers with maybe a minimal set of instructions for how to perform the review. And then they return a review eventually, perhaps sooner or later.
Perhaps, yes, I know.
And this is another thing that surprises people who are not in science. The whole thing is on a volunteer basis.
Yeah.
So people are asked to review for free. They get nothing for it. That means that often it takes a lot of time, and the reviewers do it in their spare time, maybe in the evening or in the weekend. The point that I'm trying to get to is that they perform the review in a narrative manner. They use their expert opinion. They look at the paper and they try to figure out if the findings are supported by the data that is shown. But very rarely do reviewers actually go and look at the primary data.
Right.
Or the code used for analysis.
Right.
Or try to reproduce the findings.
Exactly.
By running the code on the data or by performing the same operations.
It's basically impossible in most cases, right? Because most researchers are actually not that transparent that they actually share all these underlying research artifacts. In some cases, it's even legally problematic, right? So if you have human subject data, you cannot, you know, just put the brain scans of a bunch of people online where you may actually see who that person was, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. So there's all different sorts of reasons why this is actually a pretty difficult, but yeah. And then, so at least in the high impact journals, so one of the really major selection criteria is always novelty, right? So as you said, how novel and surprising is the result? And then you get to this sort of like this Bayesian insight that, you know, if you just take a step back and you just consider like what is the prior probability of this result being true, given that it is both novel and surprising, it is probably lower than if you would go into this focusing on hypotheses that are not that surprising or not that novel. Right. So, I mean, the very selection criteria of the high impact journal seems to be skewed towards publishing results that just have a lower probability to be true from the get-go, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I believe as well.
Yeah. So how do you think then should research quality be measured in stats?
I think we need to build some kind of systematic and transparent quality control process, so that when a reader looks at a scientific output, they can tell what kind of procedure has been followed in the vetting of this research object. And when I talk about research objects, I mean, it could be something like a scientific data set, or it could be, well, basically any digital resource that could come out of research and that you could put online. So I'm suggesting that we need to develop, based on the community of researchers, procedures and measures for quality. And we can start with the basics, like in the case of a research data set. Is it actually there?
Right.
Does it exist? Does it have the right number of observations?
Right.
Are the observations within what is possible under the laws of nature?
Right.
Like if you have a variable that is the participant's weight, and it goes to 800, something is probably wrong.
if bigger mammals probably sneak themselves into the sample.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or someone moved a decimal point or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what should be the criteria that referees and editors should look at to determine research quality?
Yeah, so some criteria of quality are to do with study design.
Right.
And there are well-known tools for assessing the risk of bias that are being used, for example, in systematic reviews, where you can look at things like, let's say we're talking about an experiment in medicine. You can ask, was it blinded? Was the blinding successful for the participants and for the researcher? Was it randomized? Was it described exactly how the randomization was performed, and so on? These are typical quality aspects of the study design.
Right.
And then you can look at how it was conducted, how the data were analyzed. Were the data analyzed according to a pre-specified plan, for example? Was there a pre-registration of what was the main outcome?
Right.
Because that's another quality problem that we see. Like if you have a test of a drug, the researchers might measure a lot of things, like how many of the patients survive at a certain time point, but also how did they rate their symptoms? What were the results of their blood tests, let's say, different biomarkers?
Right.
And that means that you can fish around after the fact and pick an outcome that you like and pretend that that was the main one.
Yeah.
But if there is a pre-registration, then the researchers have to, in a sense, tie to their hands. And then a measure of quality is whether the reporting actually follows the pre-registration.
Right, exactly.
And then whether the results can be reproduced and whether they withstand challenges to the assumptions made during analysis.
Yeah.
Things like that. I could go on.
Exactly. So how do you think we could get there? So how could journals or alternative, you know, systems to evaluate the quality of research, how could they ensure that we actually get to much more transparency about what the quality of the research actually is?
Innovation is needed, and it has been sluggish. It has been incredibly slow in the space of traditional publishing. There are some journals that do computational reproducibility checking, but to a large extent, these things that I'm talking about have not been implemented. And I think it's because of misaligned incentives, because the journal editors, they have the opportunity to allocate prestige, and any systematic procedures interferes with their latitude in doing so. I speculate that this is a misaligned incentive that is holding back innovation. Of course, I'm very excited about new disruptive publishing platforms that could take us out of the dependency on the traditional journal publishing. Of course, DSI is one such platform that I'm very excited about. I'm very excited to see the future of what's going to happen there.
Yeah, so am I, obviously. Yeah, so one of the things that you mentioned in your seminar talk was this concept of interoperable digital research objects. So I'd like to spend a minute or so to talk about what they actually are. So how would you define them? So what are the characteristics? And to which extent do you think they could actually be contributing towards a solution to the triple crisis in science and science publishing that you were talking about earlier?
Sure. So the scientific paper as we know it's static. It typically has the form of a PDF. The contributions are in the form of authorship, which means that a scientist is an author and an author is a scientist. But at the same time, it's not possible to tell usually who contributed what in a paper. And the paper itself doesn't contain, in most cases, all the information that we would need in order to know how the work was done, and how we can build on it or reproduce it. So what I was talking about in the talk was to imagine that instead of the paper, we have digital research objects that can contain some of the things that are in the paper, but also other things. So you could imagine, for example, that if I run a study, I start by writing a protocol, and then I post it publicly. Then I have information to my participants, I post that publicly. I have a data management plan, I post that publicly, and it says where the data are going to go, where the analysis code is going to go. Then the data will go in that repository. These objects will be connected through digital identifiers. Then I can have code in another repository which operates on the data and generates results that anyone can execute and demonstrate that they can get the same thing.
I completely agree that that sounds like an absolutely ideal system. But like, okay, so what are the hurdles? So what why aren't we there yet?
Much of the technology exists. I can post things online in repositories that cover most of these scenarios. Maybe not 100%, but we're well on the way there. The major problem, in my opinion, is that it's hard to get credit for publishing research objects outside of traditional journals. And that's the factor that locks us in more than any other factor to the traditional publishing system. I need to show the journal publications in order to further my career. At least that's the general perception. If I publish research objects in some other way, perhaps it's useful or beneficial, but it's hard for me to claim credit in the recognized system of merits that we've got.
Exactly. So I can completely echo that. That's also my personal observation that I've made at all the various places where I worked and like with all the colleagues that I've worked together with. So the usual struggle of most academics, especially those in the early phases of their career, is to bolster their publication record, right? So you want to make sure. So typically, evaluation committees, hiring committees, whatever, they typically look at the quantity of publications and the quality, where quality is usually approximated by the prestige of the journals in which you've published, or how many citations you've gathered for a particular piece of work. But mostly it's the prestige of the journal and like how often do you actually land a hit in these top 10 charts or whatever.
Exactly. And this is highly pernicious because it forces scientists to write papers for the sake of writing papers instead of for the sake of communicating important scientific outputs.
So how do we get out of that? So it seems like that these incentives are so deeply ingrained in the academic system, right? So it's not, I wouldn't even just blame this on the journal editors or the publication industry. It's like, at least to a similar extent, it's just the academic community itself that has created all these quantitative benchmarks to evaluate researcher productivity. And that has just like trickled down really, really deep, influencing what people do on a day-to-day basis. So I could actually, I could observe that at, you know, at Erasmus University back in the days when I was starting there, they introduced basically a point system to evaluate researchers, right? And then they had a point system to allocate research budgets, a point system that was used to evaluate whether somebody was eligible for promotion, and all of these sorts of things. And ultimately what that meant was that we had a committee where people were sitting together and they were discussing what the formula should look like. But then once the formula had been put into stone, basically all these promotion and evaluation decisions, they could have been made by a computer or by the cleaning lady, right? So there was like zero influence of human judgment or actual expertise or actually engaging with the research, right? So it was like, there was this strong belief that, you know, we have quantitative indicators of researcher productivity that are so robust and so great that we can just entirely rely on them to steer our entire system. And while that has certain convenient advantages, I could also see that, you know, once that system was introduced, it clearly influenced what people were doing. So what type of studies they started to engage in, how they shifted their priorities, you know, how they also like started allocating more and more time towards the few projects where they thought they actually have a shot at getting into these high impact journals. So especially yes. the ones that were flashy and potentially, you know, attention seeking. So yeah, you could really see that entire thing trickling down. But how do we change that? How do we get out of that? How do we improve that?
I'd like to interject a question for you here.
Please, which is, yes.
What do you think is the least quality controlled aspects of science or
the
of our
least
scientific
quality
controlled output?
I mean, that is a great question. So my, okay. So I'm not sure if this is where you're going, but I guess it's probably, so when you look at empirical research or computational research, it's probably the underlying research artifacts itself. So in particular, the mm-hmm. code. Right, so it's I don't think that anybody, with very very few exceptions, but the vast majority of referees or evaluators, they never go to the actual origin of the empirical results, which is the code and the data on which the code runs. Right.
All right. Yeah, that's an extremely good answer. I want to nominate another thing, which is our citations.
Yes. Yes, you're right. So how do you tell what is a good and what is a bad citation, right? So there's also a bunch of papers that got thousands of citations just because everybody was citing them as an example of really bad research.
Yes. For instance. Yeah, so lots of citations are simply missed citations. Yeah. Or if they're not, they can be done for a variety of reasons. Like it was it happened to be something that the writer was thinking about and they used it as an argument to make their point, or they want to show their allegiance to a particular group of scientists or whatever.
Yeah.
So the argument I'm trying to make here is that citations are a poor measure of impact. They measure something, perhaps.
They measure attention to some extent, right? So they measure to some extent whether you get traction in the academic community that you're talking to, right? So there's also this weird phenomena that some papers at some point they become stables in a particular field. And if you do not cite them in your own work that is in that field, you're missing an opportunity to signal that you actually are a member of that field. Right.
Sure.
So that you are an expert, right? So as an expert, you're supposed to know like all the key works that were done, and then you cite them. Right?
Going back to what you were asking.
Yeah.
How do we move away from citation-based metrics to some better form of appraising quality?
Yeah.
Well, one way is to rely more on experts' judgment. That is on having an expert actually read the work, but it's expensive and time consuming, and you can't read let's say I'm trying to hire you or you're trying to hire me, it would take far too long to read through our entire corpus of work. That
impossible. I wouldn't want to read all my own stuff. It's way too much. My
Me
God,
neither.
like these 200 pages of supplementary information, like who the hell is supposed to read that?
Yeah, so we need some kind of quality control that is recognized, that is portable. So, I mean, I would love to be able to send my work to some kind of independent body that could look at it according to certain standards and say, okay, here's the boxes that you tick. Your study is well designed, well executed, the data are present, the results are reproducible, or whichever standards we choose to have for the particular discipline or subfield. I want to try to make this happen.
Yeah.
Somehow, I think that's the way to build out of the reliance on journals, instead of trying to break down the current model.
Right.
To build an alternative.
Yeah. So, how much hope do you have that we can actually improve things in the foreseeable future?
I think the future is very bright.
I'm glad you say that, because I want us to end on a positive note. Please say something positive, Gustav.
I mean, there are many people working on solutions, and there is an increased uptake of practices that I like to see, like pre-registration and data sharing.
Right.
We need to find an alignment on the incentives. And I see lots of work happening both top down from large funders like the European Commission, and bottom up from individual scientists, from entrepreneurs, from communities.
Yeah.
So I'm quite hopeful, actually.
Yeah. So, okay. So I'm probably by nature of my personality, I'm an empirical realist. So I tend to be neither particularly optimistic nor pessimistic. So I'm very much driven in my judgments by just, you know, data and evidence. And like, I completely agree with you that we've seen a lot of very encouraging developments in the last couple of years, including, you know, the uptake of the open science movement, a growing recognition of the importance of replicability, a growing interest of people in understanding, you know, what the incentives are that we're operating under, and like what the consequences are. So all of that are good signs. So whether that's enough for us to actually, you know, escape from the traps of the prestige economy that we're currently in, I don't know that, but I really, really hope that you're right. We're definitely working in that direction. So we're putting all our weight into this and trying to make our small contribution to actually improving that. But yeah, so I'm very glad that you started to give us an insight into what's actually going on behind the curtain in science, and what are some of the problems, and show us some potential ways how we can improve that. Thank you very much, Gustav. This was a great pleasure having you here. And thanks also for giving the seminar, which we all really enjoyed.
Thank you, Philippe. I've loved having this discussion with you.